You have a little time to do it.
Sure.
Because I'm pushed for time. I'm going to get things rolling. But of course, that's why I record things, so all the people who are late can come back and listen to it. So we left off talking about what was going on in North Vietnam. And we know that the North Vietnamese Party is called Lao Dong. That's the Communist Party. And they have basically imposed socialism upon the people of North Vietnam, utilizing the precedents set by the Soviet Union and China. They imposed collectivization. They imposed three-year plans. They sought out people who were basically dissidents, who disagreed with the regime. They took people's land. They killed hundreds of thousands of people, all solidifying their control over the North. But as for taking action against the South, Lao Dong was hesitant. Because as we said last time, the backers of North Vietnam, the Soviet Union, Communist China, they were not keen on the idea of potentially triggering U.S. involvement. They didn't want the Cold War to become hot. But the Lao Dong could not resist taking actions, baby steps, if you will. Because they knew the only way that they could take over to the South was to basically move south. So, beginning in early 1959, the first steps began to secretly make its way down into the Republic of Vietnam. Why? Well, simple. Lao Dong basically decided that it was time to shift from propaganda to armed rebellion. Essentially, what they would do is call for the launching of what would become known as the People's War. So in addition to launching the People's War, the Lao Dong would also make three fateful decisions. The first, they started funding the construction of bases in the South, out of which they could operate. These would be mostly located in the highlands, in the most rural areas of South Vietnam. They would also begin construction of what would become known as the Ho Chi Minh Trail, a system of trails running from North Vietnam through Laos and down into South Vietnam. So one, they started building bases. Two, they're making the roads, the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And three, they also would establish a maritime route to go by sea. The goal was, in a sense, to kind of flood the zone, to make the pipelines to be able to support the People's War against Diem's regime. Also in 1959, they dispersed the first arms shipment to the South. Bringing the weapons were native Southerners, some of those cadres that went north in 1954. But after training, they would basically go home. And again, just like the system that Lenin envisioned, these would be the people that would come and plant the seeds of a Marxist-Leninist revolution. Not only are they repositioning to strengthen in the South, but they also introduced a universal draft. All males in North Vietnam would be expected to serve at least 3 years in the People's Army of Vietnam, the PAVN. By 1961, their army was over 160,000 strong. The army also was armed and trained in Western-style tactics, meaning they wore uniforms, they had ranks, they were organized based on squads and regiments and divisions. But they were trained both in conventional and guerrilla tactics. So not only did they bring in advisors from the Soviet Union and China, but they also drew upon the success of the Viet Minh, their predecessors. But in 1960, a very crucial meeting took place when delegates from the South would meet with PAVN officers. Hanoi essentially ordered the creation of a party, a revolutionary group in the South. Of course, we know the Dien administration calls them the Viet Cong. But they would identify themselves as the National Liberation Front. And I decided to save you from writing the Vietnamese because National Liberation Front in Vietnamese is 2 lines long. This group would be comprised of representatives from all anti-Diem representatives. So not just communists. It was kind of like the Viet Minh was originally a lot of nationalists. The same basic idea. So these could be Buddhists. These could be, you know, those other cult religions. These could be some of the criminal gangs that were crushed. Anybody who hated Diem could be part of the National Liberation Front. But of course, truth be told, Hanoi, through the PAVN, controlled all decisions by the National Liberation Front. The consequences of this? Organization. It was no longer little isolated outbursts here and there. Attacks started becoming more organized, more complex, more systemic, more widespread. And he was blind to the fact that instead of some thugs, he was actually facing a movement that was aiming to topple his government. Question. If I had time to do that, I would have done it on Tuesday. But we ran out of time. All right. Well, let's not think that Lao Dong, the Communist Party in the North, and the NLF, like, were perfect friends. That's not necessarily true. Their relationship was somewhat bizarre because many of the rank and file were not communists. They just did not like Diem or his regime. But at the same time, many of the leaders of the group were actually from the North. So, in order to mobilize the people, the communists could not really talk about communism. They had to focus more on nationalistic themes or anti-Diem themes. But in terms of operations, again, it was all coordinated. It was not autonomous. Why? Well, commies are good at keeping their objectives quiet. The Lao Dong kept their actual objectives hidden. And they manipulated the non-communist members into kind of going along with the program. So, for example, they talked about this being a struggle against colonialism. You know, just like they fought against the French. But of course, the new imperialist was the Americans. They also called upon or called for land reform. But they didn't tell the people in the South what was going on to the people in the North. That everyone in the North, through collectivization, lost all their land. They also said there would be democracy. But they never talked about elections. And they also promised amnesty. If anyone was supporting Saigon switch sides, they would be forgiven. But of course, if we can get to it, we will see that when the North finally beat the South, the North did lots and lots of executions. So in short, in order to be successful, they had to basically engage in politics. They had to put forth a message that could appeal to many of the different factions that existed in the South. Because if they started off with what socialists are all about, party control over everything, you have no personal rights, you have no privacy, no one would ever vote for socialists. And by the way, the socialist politicians in our country play the same game. They say, we're going to tax the rich, but they never define what rich means. Because in the minds of the socialist, rich is anyone who has even a penny more than you. But through clever pamphlets and slogans and lectures and talks, the NLF would spread real quickly throughout the villages and the rural regions of South Vietnam. And they would actually make some inroads into the cities as well. But in the cities, you had a few. Not masses. And why? Well, again, they were nationalists. They weren't fans of the idea of losing all their wealth. They just didn't like Diem. They didn't like the Americans being there. they believed that Ho Chi Minh would free them from this regime and then create a democracy like he promised. But they weren't necessarily peachy keen on all the communist stuff. And they figured that once unification occurred, that all of the harshest communist stuff would be tempered. But truth be told, the real base for the NLF was the peasants. In the Mekong Delta region alone, 50% of South Vietnam's peasantry lived, all kind of bottled up in one broad area, which made them easily accessible. Going back to when the French controlled Indochina, there were very few cities built in the Mekong Delta. There were nothing there but small villages and small towns. And there were few roads that connected to them. So they were isolated. Because they were so far out, Diem soldiers rarely risked going out into the countryside. So it basically allowed the peasants to be left unchecked. But man, when the NLF representative showed up in the villages, man, did the peasants grieve. They had lots of complaints. They had no land. The rents were high. They didn't have job opportunities. They didn't have political opportunities. They were also angry over the way that the ARVN troops moved around the countryside. If an ARVN patrol showed up in a rural village, they showed up and basically took what they wanted. They took food, they took drink, they never paid for anything. And to make matters worse, by 1958, 59, 60, there's white guys traveling with them. So in the minds of these rural peasants, those are the slave masters. They're the ones that are bringing us the pain. So, the NLF played along. Yeah, you're right. United States, they're the white devils. They're the colonists. They're the ones that are controlling everything. And they're using the ARVN as puppets. Look at, they're giving these Vietnamese soldiers American uniforms. They're giving them American ranks. They're giving them American guns, American weaponry. They must be doing America's bidding. So with very little effort, the NLF managed to create a revolutionary base that ultimately they would use in a war that would explode by the 1960s. Once they were there, though, the NLF would basically embed themselves like a tick, digging into your skin. They would go into the village and they would either murder the local governor or intimidate them to get them out of the way, and they would take political control over the villages. This basically meant, even though Diem's government didn't realize it, it was actually the NLF that was in charge of all of the rural towns.
in the population?
Well, they received political education.
They had psychological reorientation. The NLF used propaganda techniques to essentially brainwash the peasants.
Because after all, revolutionary movements, particularly socialist revolutionary movements, are not successful if you have people who are independent thinkers.
They also would have to break down the traditional values. They began undermining the traditional religious views of like ancestor worship and so forth. They couldn't have the new potential revolutionaries thinking of the past.
It's another inherent aspect of all socialist movements. You have to destroy the past. There only can be tomorrow.
But in this, they weren't always successful. Because the peasants live the life that their ancestors had for generations. All they knew was when the sun came up, you got out of bed and you went to work in the field trying to grow food. And when the sun came down, it was time to go back home. They didn't know about clocks. They didn't know about machines. They didn't care about drums. They didn't care about schools.
And the proletariat propaganda, you know, that came out of Moscow, that really didn't resonate.
Plus, the peasants initially did not make good soldiers. The biggest thing that they didn't do was they didn't take good care of their weapons. Vietnam is a tropical climate zone. You have to be able to keep your guns clean. You have to keep your ammunition dry, or it won't work. And the peasants, okay, they were trained how to use a rifle. They couldn't hit the broadside of a barn. And even if given a rifle, they just kind of put it down, let it lay on the ground, and go about their day and completely forget about it. And then the skies would open up and pour, and before you know it, the gun's all rusty.
They forgot to return to their units when they were supposed to do drills or when they were supposed to go out on operations.
And they often panicked because they didn't want to die. So if the ARVN actually fired back at them, they ran away. So the NLF had the ultimate challenge. How do you turn peasants into hardened soldiers? It's not the easiest thing to do. So, when the peasants didn't effectively serve as ground troops, the NLF had to go to Plan B. So what would they do? Well, they would train the peasants how to give first aid. They would train the peasants on how to report enemy activity. Or they would use peasants to start digging the tunnels that would begin appearing, or trenches, or the booby traps. So even if they couldn't fight with guns, they could still contribute to the war effort.
Which, of course, took time. If Hanoi had its way, there would be a sweeping revolution at the snap of a finger. But it just couldn't happen. Some places were quicker than others.
And as I mentioned previously, in some villages there were assassinations. In some places they engaged in small sabotage, blew up bridges or broke the roads to make them so they were impassable, or cut phone lines, power lines.
The Vast People's War, as was proclaimed in 1949, really just didn't happen. But the declaration by the Lao Dong was that it should get moving.
One of the first significant steps that was taken by the North Vietnamese government was creating Special Group 559. 559 was the army group responsible for maintaining and upgrading the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
This trail would allow soldiers to get around the DMZ, to allow for soldiers and munitions to penetrate the most southern regions of Vietnam by essentially traveling through all of the mountains and forested regions of Laos. And this would basically allow them to supply National Liberation Front activity anywhere in South Vietnam. But the VC remained small. Even as late as 1960, they never really numbered much more than 12,000. So you had 12,000 people operating in a country of 18 million conducting terrorist and guerrilla activities.
But they slowly started gaining experience, and they slowly started engaging in more elaborate tactics and schemes. And ultimately, they would pave the way for action anywhere in the South. Foreshadowing what was to come
would be an event that took place on July 8th, 1959. In the city of Binh Hoa, which is 20 miles south of Saigon, the United States government had been operating a major airbase. Late in the evening on July 8th, a group of six Viet Cong easily snuck through the few fences that were there and avoided the ARVN guards that were marching along the perimeter. They managed to get all the way into the interior of the base, where they stumbled upon the mess hall. Inside the mess hall were a bunch of American MAG advisors who were enjoying a movie. The movie was The Tattered Dress. Never saw it. I read the description, and it doesn't sound like a movie I would be interested in. Basically, a husband is accused of murdering somebody who assaulted his wife, and it's kind of like a legal drama. I don't know. Maybe someday I'll see it. But when the VC identified the mess hall, they put their guns in through the window and they sprayed inside with automatic weapons fire. In doing so, they killed Major Dale R. Buis and Master Sergeant Chester M. Ovenod. For a while, these two men were classified as the first deaths of the Vietnam War. In addition to these two, Captain Howard Boston was injured, as well as one of the Vietnamese cook's 8-year-old sons. The guerrillas also managed to kill 2 South Vietnamese officers. But it could have been much worse, because there was about 24 people in the mess hall. How could it have been worse? Well, one of the VC guys had a satchel charge. Explosive in like a satchel. He activated it, and he was supposed to throw it in the building. But when Major Buis, when he was shot, suddenly got up off the ground and charged at him, he kind of freaked out. And he dropped the satchel. So it blew up outside, killing him and 2 of his VC buddies. Had he not freaked out and threw the satchel in, it's possible you could have had 20 plus Americans killed, plus another dozen or so Vietnamese. Well, FYI, after this, MAG was ordered to always carry weapons. Because now the Americans had been attacked and killed by the VC. But I gotta do one side note. Who was the actual first person killed in Vietnam? Well, the first soldier killed was Tech Sergeant Richard Fitzgibbon Jr. He died on June 8th, 1956. Fitzgibbon was from Stoneham, Mass. He was a Navy veteran. He served in World War II. Then at the end of the war, he retired, but a few months later, he re-enlisted again and joined the Air Force. In 1955, he was sent to Vietnam to be part of MAG. So he was there to train. Well, on June 8th, his patrol was flying reconnaissance, and the plane apparently came under small arms fire. Well, the radio operator never called in the attack. So apparently, Fitzgibbon, being the commanding officer on the plane, confronted the radio operator and basically asked him, "You fucking idiot? Do you know how to do your job?" And the radio operator was going, "Yeah, I kind of do." Well, as it turns out, the plane got back to base safely, and the crew dispersed after its debriefing. The radio operator, Staff Sergeant Edward C. Clark, decided the best way to deal with the fact that he got yelled at was to go to the bars and get drunk.
So after being quite inebriated, he stumbled out of the bar, and lo and behold, across the street was Fitzgibbon. Fitzgibbon liked giving out candy to the children in Saigon because he was a dad and he missed his kids. So while Fitzgibbon was down on his knees giving out candy, Clark walked up behind him, pulled out his sidearm, and put 3 rounds in the back of his skull.
Well, his family would lobby, and they would work for decades to get his death recognized as a combat injury so his name could be put on the wall, the monument that's in D.C. Well, that was accomplished in 1995 when, thanks to then-Representative Edward Markey, who's our senator now, Edward Markey would lobby the Department of Defense, and they would actually change the official start date of the Vietnam War to November 1st, 1955, which was technically the starting point when MAG Vietnam started operation. So his name is first. But his story's not done. I like telling these stories because these are real men, people who lived. Well, after he died, he was in his 40s. I think he was 42, 43 when he died. His son, Richard Fitzgibbon III, decided to honor his father's service by enlisting in the Marine Corps. He would be deployed to Vietnam in 1964. And a few weeks before his tour of duty ended, he was out in the countryside and he stepped on a landmine that had been placed by the VC, killing him instantly. Richard Fitzgibbon Jr. and Richard Fitzgibbon III are one of three fathers and sons who died in the Vietnam War. Questions? Now for the last little chunk of information for your exam. The first Tuesday of the first full week in November every 4 years is what? None of you know that?
Election.
Presidential Election Day. November 8th, 1960, a presidential election took place. Dwight D. Eisenhower could not run again. He had served 2 terms, and he was term limited by the 24th Amendment. So this paved the way. In the presidential election of 1960, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, Democrat senator from the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, defeated Vice President Richard Nixon. It was one of the closest elections in our nation's history. FYI, the 1960 presidential election was the first election in which there were 50 states that participated. Because in case you weren't aware, in 1959, both Hawaii and Alaska became states. The election itself was only decided by about 100,000 votes. And it's the seventh closest election in our nation's history. The margin of victory, 0.17%. Had a few voters voted a different way in a few different counties, Nixon could have won. And yes, I will acknowledge, there's also a whole bunch of arguments out there that apparently Kennedy's father had made a deal with the mafia, which helped him basically corruptly secure the electoral votes from Illinois and Nevada, and I think New York. But regardless, John Fitzgerald Kennedy became president. On January 20th, 1961, was Inauguration Day. And the mood of the new administration was energetic. It was tough. And they believed their electoral victory was a reaction to what took place in the 1950s. But if you have opportunity to listen to the entire 16-minute inaugural address, much of it's filled with Cold War issues. What I decided to do is I snippeted a little chunk that highlights what I'm talking about. Ambitious campaigns to fight communism on every front. That's why they launched the Peace Corps. That's why they launched Food for Peace. That's why they launched U.S. Aid, which of course Trump shut down because it had grown corrupt. They launched the Alliance for Progress. Heck, he also challenged America to get to the moon. So during his administration, NASA was founded. But they also dealt with the Soviet Union. And again, if you ever have a chance to study his presidency, he had to deal with the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Turkish Missile Crisis, the Bay of Pigs, the construction of the Berlin Wall, on and on and on and on. But in this war, he also is one of the most popular presidents in our nation's history. He averaged over 70% approval rating almost all the way through his 3 odd years as being president. FYI, Biden averaged about 35%, just by way of comparison. Trump, first term, was about 39-40, but since he's become president, he's over 50. But think about that. Even at 50%, that means 1 out of every 2 people don't like him. Kennedy, 70%. It's extraordinary. And by the way, my grandmother adored him because he's the first Catholic president in our nation's history. All right. Well, why? Well, very simple. He was young, he was intelligent, he was articulate, and he was fighting the good fight. The Cold War. So, when Kennedy decided to get us more entangled than Eisenhower did, the American people generally went along for the ride. Why? Well, in 1961, the Vietnam War was nothing even close to what it would escalate to. It was nothing, and this is going to sound controversial, but I don't care. There are more American kids killing each other in our cities in the United States today than were being killed in South Vietnam in 1961. Just like you may be desensitized to all of the gangbangers, you know, shooting up the cities. You know, the people in our country were just kind of like, yeah, it's no big deal. It's just something small. It's just crime. It can be dealt with. But John F. Kennedy, interestingly enough, kind of blamed Eisenhower for allowing it to be in the state that it was. Kennedy was critical of Eisenhower's policies, particularly to the Third World. You know, think about what we talked about, what the Eisenhower administration did. It's like, okay, they knew there was problems, but we're really not going to send boots on the ground, but we'll give them money, and we'll train them, and we'll let them do what they got to do. And we'll ignore the fact that Diem is a brutal thug. Well, Kennedy was different. Kennedy was different. Because he believed that America should be more present. You know, if we're going to send money, we should actually have boots on the ground. But that doesn't necessarily mean full-blown combat. No, he felt that we should be there to help the local people build up their own armies. But the United States should also be aware of counter-revolutionary tactics. Kennedy kind of knew that in these communist revolutions, there was not going to be like the German army, you know, rolling down the streets in tanks doing a blitzkrieg. There would be no Stuka dive bombers, men in uniform. Kennedy kind of understood that more than Eisenhower did. So ultimately, he wanted to change the game. Because the game that Eisenhower was focused on, as with the Truman administration, you know, Europe, Kennedy believed that was settled. The Warsaw Pact had created the Soviet bloc, and all of Eastern Europe was under control of Moscow, whereas the rest of Europe, Western Europe, was part of NATO. Kennedy never foresaw the Russians being stupid enough to trigger World War III. So where should we be looking? Asia, Latin America, Africa, the Middle East. In other words, the world police. And, it should be no surprise, Kennedy surrounded himself with advisors that shared that perspective. Among the three names that you should remember are Special Assistant for the NSA, the National Security Administration, McGeorge Bundy. Secretary of Defense, Robert S. McNamara. And Secretary of State, Dean Rusk. These men were like Kennedy. They were young. Kennedy was 44 years old when he became president, making him the youngest president prior to Barack Obama becoming president. Bundy was 42, McNamara was 44, and Rusk was 52. The average age of the Eisenhower administration and his advisors were in the 60s. They viewed themselves not as representatives of the old guard, but no, they viewed themselves as representatives of the new generation. The baby boomers. But they also believed, almost naively, that they were kind of on a crusade. They believed America had the capacity to save the free world. In terms of Vietnam, of the three, the biggest one who impacted Vietnam policy was McNamara. McNamara had been an executive from Ford Motor Corporation. He was a businessman. He was also a master of numbers. You know how like the game of baseball was changed, you know, due to the guy from he was the manager of the Oakland A's. The Red Sox would ultimately use those kind of tactics. You know, that basically everything was based on stats. You know, you didn't, like, have a batter bat just because he could hit the long ball. No, you might be able to go get a player that will walk a lot, and he has more value than someone who might be able to hit a home run because he might have a higher OBP. Well, McNamara would look at politics through the prism of statistics, through numbers, odds. So he basically believed that he could basically encourage good outcomes by controlling the data. Now, ironically, he would remain Secretary of State for 7 years. he would be Secretary of State for Kennedy as well as Johnson. And he would be one of the few administration officials who actually traveled to Vietnam multiple times. He would go to Vietnam 9 times. So he went and he used his own eyes. Questions? All right, well, let's narrow it in. What did JFK view of this whole Southeast Asian mess that had formerly been Indochina? Well, ironically, when Kennedy became president, he was more focused on what was going on in Laos and really didn't care too much what was going on in North or South Vietnam. Laos, tiny little landlocked country that shared borders with North Vietnam, South Vietnam, Thailand, and Cambodia. Oh, it's not Thailand anymore. Was it Myanmar? I think that's what it's called. Well, 2 years before Kennedy became president, a civil war broke out there between the Pathet Lao, who were the communists, and the monarchy. The communists were attempting to basically topple the regime in order to spread communism throughout the rest of Southeast Asia. Well, ironically, the group that was training and funding the Pathet Lao was none other than PAVN Group 559. The North Vietnamese Army Group entrusted with building the Ho Chi Minh Trail. They were training the Pathet Lao. They were giving them weapons, munitions, and encouraging them to topple the regime. Two days before Kennedy took the oath of office, he had a meeting with outgoing President Eisenhower, and they sat down and they talked about everything that was going on in the world. And apparently, Ike's assessment of Laos was that it was a lost cause. He said the nation had an undeveloped economy, the government was weak, the population was divided ethnically, culturally, linguistically. It was a mess. But it was symbolic of a cork in a champagne bottle that is being shaken. If you build up enough pressure in a champagne bottle, what happens to the cork? Off it pops. So Ike's like, it's a sign of the inevitable. You know, this regime is going to fall, and it's going to basically mark the domino falls. And there's not a damn thing we can do about it. So this was actually Kennedy's first foreign policy focus. But he did not want to engage with troops. But he did something that no other president would do. He gets the United States involved through rhetoric. He actually holds a press conference. I'll play a little bit for you, because we're going to finish, because you're going to have your exam.
Come on. Everyone's talking about the salt trick that gets men rock hard. Does it really work? Well, let me tell you about my husband's experience when he tried it. It's kind of funny, but the next day I could barely sit on the toilet. Oh, I discovered
that's awful.
That's a crazy ad.
That's just a random ad.
That's a crazy ad.
YouTube is insane.
That is crazy.
And they usually link ads with the top. What the heck does a presidential press conference have to do with that garbage?
I don't know.
That year, I think it's a large group of powers agreed to a settlement of the struggle for Indochina. Laos was one of the new states which had recently emerged from the French Union. And it was the clear premise of the 1954 settlement that this new country would be neutral, free of external domination by anyone. The new country contained contending factions, but in its first years, real progress was made towards a unified and neutral status. But the efforts of a communist-dominated group to destroy this neutrality never ceased. In the last half of 1960, a series of sudden maneuvers occurred, and the communists and their supporters turned to a new and greatly intensified military effort to take over. These three maps show the area of effective communist domination as it was last August, with the colored portions up on the right-hand corner being the areas held and dominated by the communists at that time. And now next, in December of 1960, 3 months ago, that area having expanded, and now from December 20th, now to the present date, near the end of March, the communists control a much wider section of the country. In this military advance, the local communist forces, known as the Potat Lao, have had increasing support and direction from outside. Soviet planes, I regret to say, have been conspicuous in a large-scale airlift into the battle area. Over 1,000 sorties since last December 13th, plus a whole supporting set of combat specialists, mainly from communist North Vietnam, and heavier weapons have been provided from outside, all with a clear object of destroying by military action the agreed neutrality of Laos. It is this new dimension of externally supported warfare that creates the present grave problem. The position of this administration has been carefully considered.
So Kennedy, being the Cold War, is mentioning the fact that Geneva, the Geneva Convention, which divided Indochina into all these countries, all of the nations basically agreed that Laos, Cambodia, North and South Vietnam would be neutral, that there would be no entanglement. But what Kennedy's basically saying is, look, no, there are outside agents. And he actually tries pointing a finger at the Soviets, claiming that they airlifted support. But never once in this conference does he say, America's going to send boots in. But instead, he calls for a diplomatic solution. Well, the amazing thing is when the President of the United States speaks, the world sometimes listens. So, in May 1961, at the urgings of the Kennedy administration, delegates from the nations in the area, as well as the powers, once again gather in Geneva, and they basically hammer out a proposal on how they're going to do or deal with Laos. Unfortunately, the negotiations would last for 14 months. And even when they came to an agreement that was signed, unlike the 1956 Geneva Accords, almost right off the bat, the Potat Lao would violate it. By the end of 1962, North Vietnam starts sending regulars in. And by 1964, there were over 20,000 PAVN soldiers operating in Laos. They would continue to destabilize the nation. Now, the most ironic thing
is the data that survived shows that Hanoi did not care about the Pathet Lao. They did not care about Laos at all. But all they were interested in was protecting the Ho Chi Minh Trail. So they start a revolution so they can supply the South. Well, when Kennedy realizes that the communists are disingenuous, that ultimately would impact the way he set Vietnamese policy. After this, he was determined to put his foot down. But what would he do? It's great to say, like Biden did, I'm going to draw the line in the sand. But if the line in the sand is meaningless, who cares? So, in trying to figure out what to do, one of the first things Kennedy does is he brings the head of the CIA, General Edward Lansdowne, has him come back to D.C. and give an assessment. Well, Lansdowne basically tells Kennedy, I like Diem, but South Vietnam is in a critical condition. He actually reported to the president that the region could be handled as a combat area of the Cold War, but even if it becomes a hot war, there's no guarantee of success. Essentially, it would require overwhelming strength, but what would we get out of it? So Kennedy, being an intellectual, he hears this, and he's like, this is very different than what Eisenhower told me. So he wants to proceed with caution. After hearing Lansdowne's report, he moves to increase aid to the Diem administration. But as the money's going over and the weapons are going over and the advisors are going over, he just can't figure out what the heck is going on. The government makes no sense. To make matters even more confusing, he begins sending more people over. And every single report he gets is different. For example, within a few months after Lansdowne's report, Kennedy sends over Frederick Nautling Jr., who he appointed as being the new ambassador to South Vietnam, and the vice president, Lyndon Baines Johnson. Kennedy tells him, tell me what's going on. Well, Johnson comes back and reports, and I quote, the situation in Vietnam is more stable than is indicated by newspaper and other reports reaching Washington in recent weeks. LBJ essentially labels the news as fake news, although he called it journalistic sensationalism. And he's basically arguing it's not as bad as Lansdowne said. Okay, so one guy is saying it's really bad, another guy is saying it's no. What should we do about it? Well, even the advice that Kennedy gets varies. Some of his advisors says that we should basically just walk away. Call for full neutralization of the RVN, Republic of Vietnam. Just leave it alone. While others are saying, no, we need to do a full-blown invasion. We need to prop up the regime. We need to defeat communism by committing combat troops. Well, he gets sick and tired of hearing it over and over again, different ways, different recommendations. So what does he do? Well, on November 1961, he dispatches General Maxwell D. Taylor and professor of Asian studies, Walt W. Rostow. These two men would travel through South Vietnam for 2 weeks. And they came back and they reported to Kennedy directly. Both agreed that the RVN, the Republic of Vietnam, is of vital importance. They believed in the domino theory. So much so, they both proposed shifting the American role from being advisors to a limited partnership and a working collaboration. Loosely translated, boots on the ground. They would make 5 recommendations. Recommendation 1, more money. Recommendation number 2, more MAG advisors. Recommendation number 3, give the RVN helicopters. Allow them to be able to fly anywhere in country as opposed to worrying about the roads. 4, dispatch 8,000 combat troops. And last but not least, we got to start bombing North Vietnam. Increase U.S. aid, increase advisors, helicopters, 8,000 combat troops, and we need to start bombing North Vietnam. Because if we don't start bombing North Vietnam, we're not going to be able to stop the support for the VC. Kennedy gets the report, looks at the 5 recommendations, and he rejects outright number 5. He knew if the United States started directly bombing North Vietnam, that would bring in China, that would bring in Russia, and little Vietnam could escalate to a nuclear war. As through 1 through 4, he was okay with it. But he wanted to make sure that our combat troops did not directly engage. They were there as advisors only. So in the end, the policy that JFK would go along is the middle path. We're not going to walk away from Vietnam, but we're not going to get involved in creating a hot war. We're going to try to have the best of both. And that is the point when the exam stops. So, as I told you last class, I was almost there, and I got us there. How many of you would like to take the exam today? Shut up. You've got to study this stuff. How many of you want to take the exam tomorrow? Friday exam. How many of you want to take a Saturday exam? Only one. Well, 2. That leaves the... Oh, wait, 3. Saturday?
It's on. Well, you got to be
here. It's going to be on.
You're going to come on Saturday.
No better.
How you gonna come on Saturday?
Mark.
Nope. I was trying to figure that out too.
Then Saturday. No, it's only 3. So then that's the last option, Sunday.
Come on, guys.
How many people want Sunday?
Just on Saturday.
Alright, well most of the people said Saturday. So no, your final exam will be in person. And by the way, I did post it online. I don't know if your professors have been sharing the dates.
I don't remember when yours is,
but they did release the final exam schedule finally. It took them forever to do so. So let me see. Your final exam is Tuesday, May 6th at 10:30 a.m. So don't plan on going home early. Because I think Tuesday is the last day. No, Wednesday is the last day. All right, we're not the last day this time around.
What do you mean?
All my other classes are done like last week, April. Like early.
All the classes should have final exams.
What?
You go home on like the 7th or the 8th.
Which one?
May?
It's
a Wednesday.
Yeah, Wednesday is the last day of finals.
Yeah.
Finals on the Tuesday. That will be in person. But this one will be online. No, Saturday. You voted for Saturday.
I know.
3-1.
Have a good one.
We'll see you. There you go. Boom, boom. Exam number 2-3-1.
Thank you.
No. And last but not least, boom, boom. Exam number 2-3-1. Well, that's good. I can get it on, and it can count on the midterm grades.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.